Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. Whenever we hear about a disaster like wildfire, flooding, a hurricane, or drought, a question always comes to the fore: what role is climate change playing in these events, and what's the true cost of that? It can be difficult to suss that out, but there are ways to do it. It's called the social cost of carbon, and it's something that is both studied and calculated. In a few moments, we'll talk to UC Davis Professor Francis Moore about a new study that shows how we've been underestimating the true cost of carbon to our global civilization. And later on in the show, we'll look at some hopeful work being done also at UC Davis to find ways to store carbon in building materials with Sabby Miller from the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. Let's find out now about the social cost of carbon, what that exactly means and how it's determined, with Frances Moore. She's an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at the University of California at Davis. Frances, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, Frances, you caught my attention when I saw a paper that you were the lead author in the proceedings from the National Academy of Sciences, and it's called Synthesis of Evidence Yields High Social Cost of Carbon Due to Structural Model Variation and Uncertainties. Quite a, you know, that's a great science journal type title. But it's really interesting to me because I was kind of unaware of what's called the social cost of carbon. I didn't know that that was an actual thing, and I bet a lot of our listeners don't either. So could you explain what that means, the social cost of carbon?
Yeah, so the social cost of carbon is essentially our best estimate of the total kind of cost to society from a ton of CO2 emissions. And if you think about what happens when you emit CO2, maybe from burning gasoline in your car, or if it's kind of from electricity generation, that ton of CO2 goes up into the atmosphere, you know, and a lot of it will kind of stay in the atmosphere for a long time, some of it kind of essentially forever. That contributes to the warming of the planet. And that warming in turn has this kind of long-term effect on a number of kind of systems that, you know, we as humans care about and value. Those might be kind of effects on mortality, maybe effects on the economy, maybe effects on natural systems. And so what we do when we calculate the social cost of carbon is we essentially try and look at what are all those effects around the world. We try and convert those effects into common units, which are dollars, and then we kind of add them up. And what that does, it kind of gives us a number that then we can then attach to the kind of thinking about changes in emissions and the kind of value to society of reducing those emissions.
And how long have we been actually doing this? How long has the social cost of carbon been, you know, something that people like yourself have been attempting to estimate and calculate?
Yes, I would say the original kind of studies on this, or at least the kind of quantification of it, probably dates back to work by Bill Nordhaus. His original work was kind of around the 1970s, but I think maybe the first kind of estimates of what this cost was kind of date to maybe the 1980s.
And okay, let's get back to this paper. Tell us a bit about your background there at UC Davis and, you know, how you got to UC Davis and how you became interested in this topic in particular.
Yeah, so I'm a researcher. I kind of work really across disciplines, and I kind of work within environmental economics, but also kind of very closely with climate scientists as well. And so really for a long time since my PhD, I've been really fascinated by this question of kind of what are the implications of changes in climate for human societies, for human welfare, for our economies, for the things we care about? And can we, you know, how do we go about kind of attempting to quantify that? And then what are the implications of those damages for, say, optimal climate policy and what we as kind of a society should do about climate change? And so the social cost of carbon is kind of something that I've been working on, you know, since my PhD, and that was over 10 years ago.
And where did you do that work?
That was at Stanford, and so it was an interdisciplinary program in environment and resources.
It's interesting to me thinking about this lately. Yes, anytime there's a disaster, and I'm refraining on using the term natural disaster, especially in terms of these fires, because there is a lot of human elements that caused a disaster like the fires in Los Angeles. And I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm talking about where we choose to build our buildings, what we choose to build them out of, how we go about responding to disasters like this. And even things like, you know, these fires didn't set themselves. The lightning didn't strike. You know, there was a human element. I don't know if there was arson. I know there was in one case in the Eaton fire, it seems that that's true. But, you know, these fires don't start themselves most of the time. There's a human element to that. So as you said, there is always, you know, multiple factors that go into a catastrophe, like something like we're seeing unfold in Los Angeles.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that I think is true of every disaster, that it's kind of a culmination of many different elements. And then kind of, you know, what you choose to focus on and then kind of address and like kind of afterwards in terms of policy, it's like, you know, there's many different ways of kind of reducing the cost of these disasters and reducing the risks. Kind of climate is this kind of background element here that is, you know, changing the risk of disasters. And for certain disasters, it's kind of definitely increasing them. And I think kind of the dry, hot weather that we've had in California that dried out the vegetation is kind of, you know, definitely attributable in a large fraction to climate change. And that is a kind of definitely an element in shaping the background risks against which all these other components that are also very important play out. And those are things like, you know, how we've been managing forests over time, our development patterns, our building codes, all of those elements, and those collectively shape the outcomes of this changing climate.
Okay, back to this paper. Tell us a bit about your colleagues that worked on it. How many people were involved with this paper?
Yeah, so we have a total of 6 people on the paper. It was begun. It's a paper long in the making, and it did begin during the pandemic shutdowns when, you know, a lot of academic work kind of paused to some extent and people were maybe not traveling as much. You know, I reached out to like this group of collaborators that are really excellent, and they've all worked on and published on the social cost of carbon, kind of done really interesting work on it. And I kind of essentially asked them, like, would you be up for doing an exercise that looks at like what is out there in the published literature and tries to kind of summarize it and synthesize that evidence into a new understanding of the social cost of carbon. And so it's a group of people from across the US and Europe, and it's really a collaboration of all of us.
Would you like to list the other authors briefly for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's Moritz Drupp, who was at University of Hamburg and is now at ETH Zurich, James Reising from the University of Delaware, Simon Dietz at London School of Economics, Ivan Rudick at Cornell, and Gernot Wagner at Columbia Business School. It was a group effort, and it was a lot of data work to kind of pull together the review of the literature, and kind of it was really something that I don't think any single researcher could have done themselves.
And the bottom line for me reading this paper, and it also kind of dovetails into what I've been seeing from climate science in the past few years, where predictions based on modeling and, you know, what they think is going to happen in the future. It seems to me, you know, talking to climate scientists, friends of mine, that things have accelerated much greater than they had thought they were going to. That things are moving along faster than anticipated, and that's not a great thing. But in your paper, you guys also have kind of reached the conclusion that we've been underestimating the social cost of carbon. And I'd like you to maybe break down, what are some of the reasons for those underestimations?
Yes, so I think it's useful to draw a distinction between the social cost of carbon as a theoretical concept, which is this kind of valuing all these many, many ways in which the kind of climate affects human well-being. And then the thing that we're actually able to calculate. And those two things are quite different. And what we are kind of pointing out here is that there's been a lot of critiques of some of the older social cost of carbon estimates for maybe being incomplete or kind of having a kind of overly simple models of how, human well-being depends on the climate system. But there has been a lot of work by researchers, particularly maybe over the last 10 years, to really address some of those. And there's been kind of really interesting developments in the literature in terms of pushing that modeling forward in a number of ways. And what some of these models do is they kind of change in somewhat fundamental ways, these kind of the original models that we use to calculate the social cost of carbon. And yet the overall evidence from this body of literature was not really summarized anywhere, wasn't really well understood. And so that's really what we're doing here, is we're trying to look across the entire literature and to see what it says about what we know about how climate change affects human well-being, and then to kind of integrate that into our understanding. And so that's where that kind of upward revision comes from. It's really from integrating some of what we call like structural uncertainties in terms of, you know, exactly how, you know, the climate affects human well-being and the different models you could use to represent that. Some of the examples of those structural uncertainties include things like the tipping points in either the climate system or the economic system. A big one is a question of whether climate change affects the economic growth rate or just kind of the level of kind of GDP in the economy in a given year. Things about kind of how your risk aversion to kind of the considerable uncertainty that comes along with climate change, your aversion to inequality. And so all of those are elements that we look at in this paper.
Who actually uses this information? Government agencies, I would think the insurance industry would be very interested in this. And we see, especially in California, a lot of insurance pulling out of the California market because of the risk is just too great. They can't, you know, basically leverage their assets against the threats. So I'm curious about who uses this information and why is it important to them?
Yeah, it's a great question. The primary policy use of this number, the social cost of carbon, is in benefit cost analysis. So in the US, there's a requirement that federal agencies, and this also applies to a number of kind of states adopt this practice as well, that if you're kind of undertaking kind of regulatory action, maybe some other types of actions, you have to do a benefit cost analysis. And so this raises a question if you're kind of thinking about regulations that might affect greenhouse gas emissions of, okay, well, how do you value any reductions in CO2 emissions and methane emissions? And that's where this social cost of carbon comes in. And it's really kind of designed to be like the number that you can use to plug into a benefit cost analysis. And the U.S. federal government has had, since the Obama administration, a kind of process for developing a social cost of carbon for use in federal analysis. And the EPA kind of recently did a major update to that number under the Biden administration that was released in 2023.
It's also interesting, you know, thinking about it from an American point of view, because especially in California, we're such an automobile culture here. It's kind of hard to function in most of California without a vehicle. You need them to get to work, to travel. You know, sometimes the hospital you need to go to is many miles away. So we kind of depend on those vehicles, and they're a big part of carbon emissions. There's the push to go towards more electrification, but a lot of people, you know, can't afford those kind of cars. So it's interesting to me to think about this social cost, as you put it. There's just so much that goes into it, and it's hard for, you know, the average person to kind of wrap their head around what should I do and what can I do? What can I afford?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, you know, the economist's idea of climate policy, and this is something of a simplification, but it is the idea that, you know, burning fossil fuels has very real costs, but it has very real benefits too. And like, those are some of the things you just articulated, that, you know, people need energy, they need to be able to get around, you know, to the extent there are limited ways of doing that, that don't emit CO2, you know, there are very real social benefits that come from fossil fuel use. And that what we kind of should be doing is really weighing the benefits and the costs when we think about, you know, what our energy mix should look like. And that's where, you know, for any regulation, you kind of would want to, you know, you know it's going to be costly, right, in terms of kind of restricting how people can use energy. But then the question is, well, what are the benefits of that? And these are benefits that, you know, accrue globally, right? So CO2 is a global pollutant. So when you avoid emitting it, you're kind of creating benefits for really kind of everyone around the world and actually kind of going out into the future. And those are challenging to quantify, but we kind of need to be able to put some number on it. And that's the kind of exercise we're going through here.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm just kind of taking an opposing point of view here. If you're just a family and you're trying on a budget and you can't think about the benefits to society around the world sometimes when you're just trying to make sure you can pay your bills.
Yeah. So, I mean, the social cost of carbon says nothing about, you know, any individual's actions mm-hmm. or what they should be. It's a kind of quantification of this number, the actual implications for how any kind of one person or household or community or government should kind of operate is complex. Economists will usually say that, you know, a desirable climate policy would be one that put a price on carbon emissions. And the kind of target for that price would generally be the social cost of carbon, right? So the idea then is that by putting that price onto fossil fuels, you kind of help people understand the external cost of their actions, right? So if you kind of put this price on, you kind of internalize this external cost into people's decision-making. And, you know, it may well be that for many people, it's still, you know, really essential and the kind of people need to be using fossil fuels. But then, you know, over time, it might well be that some of the costs of these alternate technologies come down or people can realize they maybe don't need to drive quite as much. They can start to make kind of these different decisions that ultimately kind of would lower carbon emissions.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with UC Davis Professor Francis Moore as we talk about the true social cost of carbon. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our interview with Francis Moore. Francis is an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis. And we're talking about the social cost of carbon, how it's determined, and how we have likely been underestimating it. As you looked across all of this literature that you had to peruse and go through to write this paper, what were some of the things that kind of really stood out and surprised you?
One of the elements that we brought into this paper was a survey of the authors of the study that we are looking at. And so the reason why we wanted to do that was we kind of wanted to say, look, there's a set of published estimates of the social cost of carbon, but can we put those into a like bigger context by really kind of delving a little more deeply with the actual authors of those studies to understand how they understand, you know, the set of estimates that exist in the literature. And one of the things we found is that the kind of authors that responded to our survey really believe that the published values in the literature are kind of underestimates of the kind of true cost. And that there's a number of things that our current like abilities to estimate the social cost of carbon lead us to underestimate. And so those are things like, we just know that we're missing some damages, but we're also kind of, you know, maybe underemphasizing some really important aspects of damages that are maybe more difficult to model. They don't show up as much in the literature. And so when we ask experts, they believe that the published academic literature on average is underestimating the social cost of carbon by about a factor of two.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a lot. And there was an interesting quote in the article, and I wonder if you could maybe explain and comment on it. It said, the greatest and widest ranging market failure ever seen is what this is. Mm-hmm. Could you, you know, kind of comment on what is meant by that?
Yeah, so I think that is a quote from the Stern Review, which was a kind of major review of the economics of climate change commissioned by the UK government and led by Lord Nicholas Stern, a UK economist. And that was a term that they used to describe climate change. And that term market failure, what that means, it means that under a set of economic assumptions, like we generally believe kind of private markets can operate in a way that generates kind of large social benefits or potentially even maximal social benefits. But if there's a problem in those markets, and that's what's termed a market failure, then, you know, private decisions, and that's just kind of people behaving as just normal kind of consumers and businesses, like going, you know, buying and selling. That's actually going to generate a kind of loss in social well-being. And in this case, that loss in social well-being is coming from the fact that, you know, burning fossil fuels generates all of these external costs around the world that are not reflected in the prices we pay privately to consume those fossil fuels. And that means there's this kind of this wedge between, you know, what people are doing and what would be most socially desirable if we're thinking about kind of the welfare of society overall. And so that's and greatest and widest ranging kind of refers to the fact that, you know, this is a phenomenon that lasts centuries into the future, right? In that sense, it's like quite different from most other economic phenomena that like economists look at. And it's really like it addresses, you know, energy use, which is quite fundamental. It's like one of the most fundamental inputs into our economy. And so the kind of combination of that, like very, that global scale, the long time scale, and the kind of really like essential economic nature of the energy use that we're talking about here is what leads us to kind of you refer to that quote of climate change as the greatest and widest ranging market failure.
Anytime someone like yourself and your colleagues work on something like this, you're using modeling, which is a very useful tool and something we're getting better and better at. Could you tell us a bit about the kind of modeling used to try to determine the social cost of carbon?
Yeah, so what we're doing in this paper is we are drawing on many papers. I think in total we have about 150 that have estimated the social cost of carbon. And so then, so what those papers are doing is they are using models that, in general, to calculate the social cost of carbon, you have to somehow connect what is typically a simple model of the climate system to a model of the economic system. And you have to, at the very least, kind of have some representation of how CO2 kind of translates into changes in temperature over time, and then how those changes in temperature over time kind of translate into human well-being. And those models kind of differ exactly in how they do that, but kind of fundamentally, that is what these models are doing.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. There's these big events that happen, like, for example, these fires in the Southern California, or you know, we've had them throughout the West, or hurricanes. How do those big impact events factor into some of these social costs? Are they factored in?
Yeah, again, I would kind of come back to this distinction between the kind of theory of what we would like the social cost of carbon to measure and what we are actually able to measure. And it's the case that if you dig into a lot of these, the damages that we're really able to quantify with confidence, these ones that come from extremes are really not among those. And so when we talk to our experts in our survey, what you see is they believe there's some underestimate of the social cost of carbon, and some of that is because we know we're missing some of these damages. Some of that is because the climate science is quite uncertain. So I think that's particularly the case with hurricanes. The question of like what exactly will climate change do to hurricanes, kind of, you know, in the near future is complex. And then some of that is just, you know, our ability to quantify this out into the future and model it is challenging, and that when we're doing social cost of carbon calculations, we need to do it at a global scale, and we need to do it out very far into the future. And to the extent we're able to project some of these, it's often at a more local scale, and it's often kind of, maybe only out like a few decades into the future. And so that's why you kind of, you know, see a bit of a lag between what we can even see climate change doing today, and what we're really able to integrate into the social cost calculation.
Yeah, because whenever there's a huge disaster, you can put a dollar amount on it. You know, there's so many homes destroyed and so much economic damage. But, you know, factoring in like, well, okay, what exact role did the climate play in that, and how much of it, what percentage, that's not easy to figure out.
That's not easy. But people are, you know, there is a work on this, and it is getting, I would say, kind of better and better, like, you know, in terms of how people are able to do that. How that then translates into like these kind of questions about like, well, what will happen in the future? How will the overall distribution of risk change, not just like, you know, for a single event like that? You know, and that's what we're thinking about here for the social cost of carbon, and that, you know, that's like a very different question. And it's one that I don't think we've made as much progress on.
Well, before we wrap this up, I'm curious about, you know, what are some of the things you're working on in the future and some of the things you see on the horizon that might be, you know, hopeful, interesting ways that maybe artificial intelligence and, you know, better computing power, better modeling might be able to help us to understand this actual social cost of carbon.
Yeah, so I've gotten very, like, as we've kind of talked about in the conversation already, this question of, you know, what's happening to insurance markets under climate change, I think is fascinating and also of quite urgent policy import. And so those are some areas that I'm working on now, and kind of trying to understand the types of models the insurance industry uses to understand climate risk are very different from the ones we've been talking about here today. So they use these things called CAT models or catastrophe models. In contrast to like the social cost of carbon models, they're very focused on extremes. They're very high spatial resolution. They're really kind of designed for like the present day and very near future. And so understanding how climate change is kind of affecting that risk environment that these CAT models are representing, I think, is really interesting. And, you know, to the extent that they're giving insurers information that is not publicly available, because a lot of CAT modeling is done privately, you know, this can lead to a lot of tensions around in insurance markets and the kind of regulation and pricing of insurance. And so that's an area I'm really interested in. I'm also fascinated by, you mentioned AI and the progress that has been made in particularly weather modeling, like AI, machine learning based weather prediction is just mind blowing. And so there's a kind of particularly a group at Google that has been training these kind of big neural network models on kind of weather forecasts and some of the more commonly used weather models. And their performance in doing this is really impressive. And I think has taken a lot of people by surprise. And so those techniques are kind of even now kind of being incorporated back into some of the weather prediction that we're doing. And then the question of like, could we adapt some of this for understanding kind of climate impacts as well in the near term, I think is really interesting.
And of course, a lot of work went into writing this paper, all of the research and collaboration. What did you personally find most rewarding about this project?
I mean, I was really happy that by the end, we were able to draw together the work that's been done in the environmental economics community, because I think the community as a whole has really responded to some critiques in interesting ways. And it has really been like delving deeply into these questions of like, why does climate change matter for us as like for our society? So I like full credit to all the researchers that have been working on that. And that was what we were able to synthesize in this paper. But then I was really excited that we could then bring in this additional context from our expert survey and combine those two lines of evidence together into this really, I think it's fair to say, quite innovative approach where we generate this synthetic social cost of carbon. And that's one that is in some ways like statistically based, like it's not based on a particular model, but it is kind of integrating a lot of, you know, the underlying evidence, both from the published literature and our expert survey, to kind of develop this, like, you know, I would say kind of more fully informed distribution of the social cost of carbon. So for me, it kind of that whole package kind of came together really nicely in a way that I think told us a lot about, summarizes a lot of the kind of newer evidence over like what drives these damages.
Well, Frances Moore from the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis, thanks for sharing your expertise with us and explaining this very complex topic to us in a way that's pretty easy to understand for me, at least, and it gave me a much better grasp on what the social cost of carbon really means.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. It was great fun.
Thanks to our guest, Frances Moore, Associate Professor in the Department of Environmental Science and Policy at UC Davis. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll visit with another UC Davis professor, this one from the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, to discuss some innovative and promising work being done to take some carbon out of the global geochemical cycle and store it in building materials. You won't want to miss that. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Our next guest is Sabby Miller. She's an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Davis and a faculty scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She's doing innovative work on how to store carbon in building materials. Sabby Miller, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are involved in some really interesting research there at UC Davis, working with material science as related to carbon storage and, you know, working on the big problem of climate change. Could you tell us like how you first got interested in these kinds of topics? Because it's really very important and it's interesting work you're doing.
I think there are probably many drivers that resulted in our working in this particular area. All of the students in my group, and of course, I'm concerned about this as well, have a deep interest in understanding how we can reduce our damages on the environment as humans and ideally start to undo the damages that we've already kind of placed on the environment. And so with climate change being a huge driver for many areas of research, it was one area that kind of sparked a lot of interest of how can we start to potentially create avenues that would help us undo some of the damages that we've currently done to the atmosphere in terms of our emitting greenhouse gases. So I think that was kind of one of the biggest drivers is here's a huge challenge. Is there anything we could do to help?
And a lot of us, when we think of climate change, we just think of emissions, you know, from automobiles and production of coal power, things like that. But a huge amount of carbon is put into the atmosphere through building processes, particularly concrete and steel. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, how those processes put carbon in the atmosphere?
Yeah, so I'm not going to have the perfect statistics right in front of me. There's a handful of drivers tied to our built environment that are facilitating emissions. One's actually our using buildings, right? So we require a certain amount of heating, cooling, lighting, et cetera, while we're using our built environment. And that actually results in energy consumption, and most of our energy resources still have a certain degree of emissions associated with them. So that's one huge area of research is but as you noted, my group's working a little bit more on what's oftentimes referred to as embodied carbon. So when we're actually manufacturing a material, there's a certain degree of emissions associated with getting the raw material resources, processing them, transporting them, converting them into that final product. There's energy demands associated with those, chemical reactions associated with those, and those lead to carbon emissions as well. And that's actually what you just touched on, is that the industrial manufacturing of our materials is a large driver of greenhouse gas production, with steel and cement being among the two largest for our industrial material production. And this is where the statistics are a little bit off. We're approximately 7% of our global CO2 emissions are coming from each of those based on the most recent reports that I've seen, but I could be off by a percentage or so. But for just two materials, contributing each about 7% of our anthropogenic CO2 emissions is kind of a large challenge that we're facing. So we have to decarbonize these materials if we want to meet our climate goals.
And what is it specifically in the making of cement that puts carbon dioxide in the air?
Well, one of the biggest drivers is that we use a lot of cement. So right now we consume about 4 billion metric tons of cement every single year. As a global society, this is not just one location. This is the entire planet. So when you consume that much of anything, it's going to have a pretty notable impact associated with it. But then on top of that, what we end up seeing with cement in particular is that there's both energy-derived emissions as well as process-derived emissions. The energy resources are for a high-temperature process that's required in the cement production, and the chemical-derived process-related emissions are actually because we start off with limestone as one of our key ingredients to make cement. There are other ingredients as well, but limestone is one of our dominant ones. And in order to get a reactive compound for that cement product, we need to remove carbon dioxide from the limestone. We effectively decarbonate it. And currently, we are sending that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we're starting off with a limestone compound, turning it into a calcium compound that's reactive, and that chemical conversion releases carbon dioxide that would have otherwise been bound in the limestone. So there's two main drivers from the actual production of the cement. And then, of course, when you scale it to 4 billion metric tons, it's a notable impact.
Limestone, seashells, basically, that have been turned into rock. It's made of calcium carbonate. So that totally makes sense to me. Some other interesting work that you're doing is on how we can go about storing carbon in building materials that we use for, you know, making these buildings. And that seemed really interesting and promising to me. Tell us about a bit about that work.
So there are many researchers working in this space. Basically, the idea is that a large amount of the materials that we consume either currently are based on carbon or could be based on carbon that would get relatively similar performance. The carbon resources that we use for a lot of these materials are oftentimes things like fossil resources. So, for example, with plastics, we're still heavily dependent on our petroleum resources for the carbon that's in our plastics. But if we were instead able to use a carbon resource that perhaps came from direct air capture, or came from CCS, or came from some other mechanism like a biogenic resource that had effectively undergone photosynthesis, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then the materials that are using that carbon could act as a storage mechanism for carbon that otherwise would have been either emitted or be in the atmosphere. So the idea in that particular vein of work is how can we start to utilize the materials that we already want as a society as a means to store our carbon so we're not reliant on things like geologic reserves for that carbon dioxide.
And could you give us some examples of how you would actually go about using these kinds of materials instead of what we're using now?
Different classes of materials have different options in terms of how we could start to alter them. Asphalt is actually a very interesting one because the asphalt pavement we currently use, the binder is a bitumen that's a residue from our petroleum refining processes. Folks are looking into things like, what if we were to instead cultivate a bio oil, so cultivate the plant and then convert it into a bio oil and use that instead of our bitumen from petroleum refining? What if we were instead to continue to use the bitumen, but maybe use other recycled compounds as the aggregate that's in the asphalt pavement system, because the asphalt pavement is actually a bitumen holding together crushed rocks. So maybe we can replace those crushed rocks. In the areas of looking into other forms of building materials, there's exploration in trying to change how we process our concrete or manufacture our concrete rather. So concrete is in fact a composite material that's made out of cement, water, and aggregates. Again, aggregates just being crushed rocks. So cement itself we discuss regularly because of its carbon dioxide emissions, but it's actually not our final product for the built environment. Cement is a hydraulic binder. It interacts with water and we'll have it as a binder that then holds together these crushed rocks. So there's people exploring, what if we can come up with a different type type of cement that has the ability to store carbon? What if we have a different type of crushed rock that cement is holding together, and that crushed rock is able to store carbon? And then, of course, there's all these different types of biomaterials, such as bioplastics. So instead of using the petroleum resources for the carbon and plastics, what if we were using plant-based material? There's exploration in terms of using varied amounts of wood products. We're already kind of comfy with wood in the built environment. What if we're able to change our manufacturing systems, improve our forest management such that we can create net storage tied to the utilization of wood? Again, that does require appropriate forest management strategies. But there's many different avenues because there's so many different materials that we consume. So it's down to kind of understanding what materials do we need, what performance do we need out of those materials, and is there an alternative to making the material such that we get the same or improved performance, but with that ability to store carbon because we've selected the carbon source appropriately.
And can you tell us at UC Davis what kind of facilities you have at your disposal? Do you have like a lab where you're able to produce these kinds of new materials and experiment with them?
Yes, our lab is producing a handful of these types of materials. We also have many collaborators on campus that are also producing similar types of materials, carbon storing materials. So in our facilities, we're a little bit more on what I refer to as the smaller scale of testing. We're actually making materials at a scale where you could plop it in your hand and then test the material. But this includes materials such as alternative types of cements, alternative types of aggregates, as well as the utilization of biochar in some types of composites like plastic composites and in concrete composites as well. And then, of course, we have collaborators in other areas that are exploring things like reducing the impacts tied to fire. And what if we were instead using that woody biomass to create more materials that could then store that carbon in the built environment instead of emitting that carbon during combustion. And we have a really phenomenal research facility on campus that's looking at all of these different alternatives for pavement systems. And they have an astronomical testing facility that I don't think I'd be able to fully give this, you know, true honor to it, but basically able to test all sorts of different pavement systems under appropriate loading conditions to know what if we were to change out how we were manufacturing our road systems in order to reduce environmental impacts associated with them.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because often we think about academic institutions like UC Davis as just, you know, doing pure research. But this is some really practical things being done. Like you were talking about the Center for Road Materials and things like that. That's kind of a neat aspect of UC Davis, is that it has that hands-on, you know, here's things we can do in the field aspect to that school there.
Yes, I think it's really wonderful. It's all the way from the deep in theory through the applied and how do we actually get this into use and how do we make sure everyone's on the same page in terms of all the contractors, builders, et cetera, that would need to potentially install the material. Also, UC Davis is so close to the capital of California that there's many faculty here who are trying to understand how do we bridge these novel developments in technology to the policy that would actually potentially support or hinder implementation of different types of strategies, but basically trying to come up with a more holistic approach is really a true cornerstone to this university.
Could I ask a question? This is
sure.
a favorite subject of mine. I was wondering if you've looked into or if this is part of your research about reusing waste that is kind of inherent with construction to create mass for insulation.
We have been looking into the utilization of resources that are coming out of use. We refer to it as resource circularity, right? So a material that you potentially would otherwise dispose of, whether that be construction waste or whether that be demolition waste at the end of the material's life cycle, there are these product flows that basically are coming out of each installation, just like a wee bit of waste that's coming associated with each step that we make as a society. And the reutilization of those waste streams could actually be a fantastic way to reduce the amount of raw material. We haven't focused in on construction waste as a insulation material. What we have been looking at is a bunch of different types of alternative insulation materials. So interestingly enough, things like food waste actually came up a little bit more often in the work that we've been conducting when it came to insulation materials. Obviously not something that would biodegrade in your wall, but rather the fibrous materials that's left over from different types of cultivation practices for food materials. Can we use those as insulation? So there's many different strategies for reusing waste resources, whether they come from construction or otherwise, as a potential building material, insulation material, flooring material, something that doesn't have that same loading on it that you would put on your beams and columns, where you really want to make sure it's performing absolutely perfectly. But again, I have not personally explored construction waste as an insulation material, so I feel like I won't be able to articulate a response to that one remarkably well. But there's definitely interest in the use of, again, circulating materials through our economy, as well as altering our insulation materials so that we, exactly as you mentioned, get that great utilization phase out of our buildings while also reducing the amount of things that we're sending to a landfill.
Yeah, it would seem to me that, you know, by taking the materials we've already extracted from the earth and getting the most out of them instead of extracting more makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you know, with some of these concrete materials that you're experimenting with for building, and then do you go on and test them, you know, from an engineering point of view for stability and see, you know, how they compare with traditional materials?
Yes. So, We my group personally stay on the smaller end of the spectrum. We do go all the way through things like strength testing and certain forms of durability testing, but we oftentimes are collaborating with other faculty, both at UC Davis and at other institutions, to do things like structural testing. So my personal research group does not ever make a full concrete frame, but we do have collaborators who do. So we're more at the development stage of, can we even make this material from a lab bench scale? Can we actually get things to react properly so that it solidifies, so that it develops strength, et cetera? Do we have any issues tied to the microstructure that we would kind of have be a red flag in terms of durability? And once we get something that's working really well at our scale, we then start to work with collaborators to see if we could fully scale it up and get the correct behavior out of a full structure.
And have you had some materials that you have indeed fully scaled up with collaborators?
There are some materials that are getting pretty far into piloting. So actually, one of our collaborators is trying to do a much more systematic approach for how materials make it from that lab bench scale into the adoption of effectively practice. And we've seen that a huge barrier is that you could do a huge amount of testing at that lab scale, really verify very standard performance characteristics, but we don't have the appropriate testing for some things that are just practical, what a contractor needs on a day-to-day basis. Like, is this easy to pour the material into place, to actually install it? There's no standardized lab test for how easy is it to install for a lot of our materials. And so she's actually working on a new way to systematically address, well, if we have developed a new material at that lab scale, what additional knowledge needs to be conducted at a university or a state institution or a federal institution to make contractors actually able to adopt it. And that's actually one of the little gaps that we're trying to fill in right now.
Could you explain that a little further? What do you mean by the gaps?
So have you heard of the Valley of Death in terms of technology readiness level for tech companies?
No, explain that to me.
Okay. So the idea is basically there's a few different levels of how ready a technology is, starting off with, can it even form? Is this something that's thermodynamically feasible? Can we even get it to react properly, et cetera? All the way through, is it being piloted, used, et cetera, being at the very high end of that scale? And what we end up seeing is that there's a huge amount of potential research that could happen at a very low technology readiness, right? Actually getting it to work in a lab setting. And then there's the pretty notable amount of investment when you're trying to actually pilot something and get it into use. So at that higher end of the technology readiness, but right in the middle, there's this valley of who's actually investing in this particular technology. So low end, you've got investment of researchers, high end, you've got investment of people trying to actually figure out how to use it. And then in the middle, there's a valley of effectively death where no one's paying attention to the technology or very few folks are paying attention to the technology. So the idea is basically that, again, one of my collaborators is leading it. We're just trying to support from the carbon utilization and low carbon technology perspective. But is there a standardized approach that can get developed to overcome some of these hurdles and actually make people feel more comfortable utilizing a product? And when something that's been particularly challenging with construction materials, because there's a lot of risk tied to the utilization of construction materials. If we have a failure in one of our construction materials, there could be potentially life affecting issues, right? If a building falls down, that is not okay. And we never want to come up with a low carbon alternative that's not going to be safe to use. We only want to come up with strategies that still perform exactly how we want, or even better, ideally also with that low emissions associated with it. So the work is basically trying to understand, okay, we're coming up with new low carbon technologies around the country, around the planet. Researchers are trying to figure out, how do we reduce emissions? How do we store carbon in our materials? This is something that's really a interesting challenge that many folks are trying to take on. We know that there are groups that are eager to use low carbon materials as long as that risk has kind of been mitigated, so that there isn't that concern that a structure won't perform properly, or someone might lose their PE license, their professional engineer license, because they specified a material that hasn't ever been specified before. How do we overcome that gap between new materials are being developed, we know they have the potential to potentially reduce emissions, to getting those materials into practice, getting over that particular gap, and coming up with a systematic strategy that can be implemented broadly, not that it's only at one university that this is happening, but rather folks can do it in many different areas, as long as they're following this kind of rubric of how to proceed through testing and verification, and have that third party validation. So it's not just one person looking at a problem, but rather making sure that there's external parties verifying that those are the results, and actually getting that to be a way to start to reduce risk so that materials can get adopted a little bit faster.
Well, Savvy Miller, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Davis, thanks for sharing your expertise on carbon emissions and building materials and how those two things can work together in a much better way in the future. And thanks for your work on this. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks again so much for having me.
Thanks again to our guests, Francis Moore from the UC Davis Department of Environmental Science and Policy and Savvy Miller from the UCD Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.